Welcome to part 7 of the PDH online course for NFPA 72, the Fire Alarm Code. We're doing the 2007 edition. I promised we would come back and talk about central monitoring and underground facilities, and it doesn't run long. This course is not addressing central monitoring except to provide a single anecdote. A large Midwestern city undertook a $15 million security project, which included a central monitoring facility. An incidental plan was to eliminate all monitoring contracts for fire and security alarms. The central monitoring facility was built, but the contracts were continued. The city was told that Homeland Security regulations required that central monitoring facilities be underground with access control and magnetic locks on all entrances. Central monitoring is a requirement out of NFPA 72 for fire alarm systems. This is unrelated aside, or maybe related in some way, and we can learn something from it. Installation requirements. The Fire Alarm Code has extensive installation requirements. They're not the responsibility of the system designer. For reasons of liability, the designer must not provide detailed instructions or detailed drawings. Please see the PDH online courses on professional liability to understand the distinction between design and means and methods. The designer must reference the Fire Alarm Code and National Electric Code for installation requirements. These codes give detailed information and drawings. Note that the addition of each code must match that adopted by the locality. They get very testy if you reference a newer code, which has deleted a favorite requirement. Testing requirements. Again, testing is critical to a reliable fire alarm system. This stage 2 comes under the installing contractor's responsibility, not the designer. The local AHJ must certify the results, not the designer. Make the reference in the specification and drawing notes. Knox box. It is good for firefighters to be able to enter the building to determine if a fire exists or simply a false alarm was received. The almost universal solution is a very substantial box at the door. The box contains a door key. The box can be opened by a key carried by the firefighters. The box can have a tamper switch connected to security or fire alarm, but this is rare. Brand name is Knox box. Common errors in fire alarm design. The following is a list of comments by plans reviewers. Many jurisdictions use a checklist, which they jealously guard. Each problem is followed by a comment on what to do to avoid the difficulty. Missing pull stations within 5 feet of exit doors. Review the final construction drawing set just before it goes out. Architects sometimes change their minds, and isolated outdoor storage rooms become alternate paths of egress with the addition of an inside door. Missing duct detectors on large air handlers. Get a list from the HVAC designer and check the final plans and schedules before release for bidding. Don't forget the remote test reset stations. No smoke detector over the fire alarm panel. Well, put one in, even if it appears excessive. No strobe-only alarm in every bathroom. Now, again, there is a range of discussion on this, and only the authority having jurisdiction can give you an absolute decision. Usually, a strobe horn is required. Usually a strobe horn with a volume control or strobe speaker with a volume control is acceptable. In something like the principal's private potty, you can get by with a strobe only. And let me tell you, that will get his attention. This is a federal ADA requirement and has been slow to be recognized by designers and reviewers. If the architect says no, you must get it from him in writing. No flow switch on sprinkler zones or outside sprinkler bell. Get a list from the piping designer and check the final plans and schedules before release for bidding. Some localities also require a sprinkler or fire alarm outside strobe, and you have to check to see what's required. Initiating devices. A sketch similar to the one below introduces the section in the National Fire Protection Association 72 Fire Alarm Code Handbook. It illustrates the expected behavior of an undisturbed fire at the early stages. Now, warning, caveat, before we talk about this typical fire, remember there are a large number of assumptions before a real fire matches this assumed typical fire. So this is conceptual, and it helps to get the ideas in mind, but it is not meaningful for a real fire unless all of the assumptions are met. And we were showing a box in the middle of the floor and some kind of stuff on it, which is kind of undefined. The stuff is on fire. The smoke goes up from the fire and spreads out as it approaches the ceiling. It's called a ceiling jet, and it's called a fire plume. They talk about the fire plume center line. They say the hottest gases and smoke are at the very center of the plume, which makes sense because it's surrounded by cool gases, room gases, and obviously there's a gradient between the cool and the hot. So the hottest is at the center where the gradient is slowest to reach it, and the coolest is at the perimeter where it's actually diffusing into the surrounding air in addition to the heat transfer into it. Now, the assumptions here, and we're not going to pursue this because this is the field of fire science, and it's not different. It's very closely related, but it's worth 3 hours separate study. There's no question about it. Obviously, what's burning makes a lot of difference in what kind of smoke you get out of it. A lot of fires start with smoldering. And it's wonderful if you can identify a fire being present before there's any real damage done. If you can have a sensitive detector and it picks up this smoldering plume before there's actually a fire plume, you're way ahead in the game. But only some materials do this. I think like a photoelectric detector picks up particles. Well, if all you're getting is vapors and a gaseous discharge, there's no particles there for the photoelectric to pick up. On the other hand, an ionization detector is real happy with vapors, with most vapors, let's say. And I'm not enough of a chemist to talk to you about how the ionization detector works and which ones it's more sensitive to and which ones it ignores. The ceiling height is very critical in this conceptual design. I hope we mentioned it previously when we were talking about putting a detector at the peak. If you've got a sloped roof, you don't put it all the way at the peak, because if you think like this fire plume going up, it bends away from the peak. It doesn't go to the peak and stop because there's no place for it to go from the peak. So it doesn't go into the peak. It goes along the peak some distance away from the peak. So that's where you want your smoke detector, where the ceiling is being washed by the ceiling jet and it's going to get the new particles coming through it. And again, the higher the ceiling, the more cooling there is, and you reduce the concentration of the materials that are going up there also. In some cases, they won't reach all the way to the ceiling. It's a separate concept entirely to protect high, like a seven-story atrium. There are ways to do it. It's done every day, but it's not just put a smoke detector there and walk away from it. The field of fire science is now sufficiently mature that details of fire mechanics under a wide range of environments and influences can be accurately predicted. The sketch is a most simple representation. It's good for conceptual purposes, but lacks detail available for analysis of real fires under real conditions. The narration in the Fire Alarm Code Handbook makes clear that the code does not require a fire alarm or particular form of installation. Local law or interpretation require the fire alarm. The code tries to force a functional, reliable installation after the decision has been made. For years, the code body has been trying to remove opportunities for the local authority to gut the code. However, the requirements and enforcement still remain local. Must support initiating devices separately of their wires. This sounds like such a no-brainer that why do we even say it out loud? Well, the reason you say it out loud is you wouldn't believe how many smoke detectors are temporarily hanging by their wires for years and years and years. I see this in hospitals. I see this in research laboratories. I see this in warehouses. I see this in factories. It's not legal, but typically no enforcement exists after acceptance of the original installation. It's also, by the way, a violation of the National Electric Code, which has trouble getting enforcement after the initial inspection also. Total coverage, all rooms, halls, storage areas, basements, attics, lofts, spaces above suspended ceilings, accessible spaces including closets, elevator shafts, enclosed stairways, dumbwaiters, shafts, and chutes. Now, there are some exceptions to this. I don't think you have to put smoke detectors above the drop ceiling if there's nothing flammable up there. I'm very clear and remember reading this in the code, but above ceiling, here, it says it. I don't have to remember things. Boy, I'm happier if I don't have to remember it. Inaccessible spaces without combustible materials do not require coverage. Smoke detectors are not required in above ceiling spaces if duct detectors are used and no flammable materials exist in the above ceiling spaces. In the action item here is to verify that only plenum rated data and communications cables will be present. And this is very hard to do if you're going into an existing building and they won't let you gut the existing cabling up there. And by the way, the electric code says you've got to rip out that old cable if it's not in use. Well, how do you know if it's in use? There's a problem for the electrical designer there. Well, there's also a problem for the fire alarm guy, because if it's flammable cable, it's got to have a smoke detector up there. If it's flammable cable, it's not permitted to be in the plenum space anyhow. But selective coverage. If only a portion of a building is being protected, then that portion must meet all requirements of the code. Comment on this is owners are always looking for just a little fire protection. If accepted, the just a little must be done in full compliance with the code. Heat sensing fire detectors. The handbook lists many different technologies that the code and in addition, the code accepts new technologies that meet the requirements for protection. Most common, however, are fixed temperature and rate of rise. I've also mentioned fire signature a couple times in here, and I don't think I got into it in detail. Fire Signature is a brand name of Simplex, and what they do is they use an analog addressable detector. Analog addressable means that it is digital in that it's addressable, but it actually transmits a numeric value of what it sees. For a heat detector, it would be a numeric value of the temperature. For a smoke detector, it would be the numeric value of the obscuration factor, that is how much the light transmission is diminished, or ionization. I don't know how ionization is measured, but it transmits a numeric value. Well, what's the significance of the numeric value? Don't you just compare it with a threshold? When you're over the threshold, you trip? Yes, but beyond that, you can do rate of rise. Rate of rise is real keen for heat detectors. Now, until recently, this was done mechanically within the heat detector. A rate of rise detector had some kind of little things with pins and levers and wonderful mechanical stuff that was able to respond to a specific rate of rise and close the switch contacts. Well, now you use the software to trend the temperature, and if you meet they draw a line on each side of a curve, and if you stay within that curve, the rate of rise envelope, then it calls it a rate of rise alarm and trips the system. Well, you can do a lot fancier stuff than that, and the lot fancier stuff is beyond my comprehension, but the lot fancier stuff is called Fire Signature by Simplex. And what it means is using the capabilities of the computers and the understandings reached through fire science to identify that a fire is happening before it would be determined by simply the obscuration value or the temperature value. Heat detector, rated linear spacing, not greater than 50 feet. Later section says to use 30 feet is the normal spacing. This takes care of the natural round pattern of sensitivity and provides a moderate overlap of adjacent detectors. Ceiling heat detectors not within 4 inches of the wall. Wall heat detectors should not be within 4 inches of the ceiling. And once again, we're talking about a dead zone in that corner where the ceiling jet doesn't penetrate. It's got no place to go. There's no reason for the air to move that way. I mean, it goes from a source to a destination, and that corner is not part of the path from the source to destination. Solid joist construction, space heat detectors at 50% of the smooth ceiling spacing, that is 15 feet center to center. And yes, we're talking about a lot of detectors. For a peak ceiling, put them within 3 feet of the peak, but not at the peak. Very high ceilings, at 20 feet as opposed to 10 feet, which is what we normally think of for commercial installation. At 20 feet, heat detector spacing should be reduced from 30 feet to 18 feet. At 30 feet, heat detector should be reduced to 10 feet. And once again, if this method is followed, that's an awful lot of detectors. Smoke detector environmental limits, 32 to 100 F nominal. Humidity below 93%. Air velocity below 300 feet per minute. What does that mean? Well, that's this fancy thing we were talking about very early on the duct detector, where it's got two tubes that sample the airflow within the duct. The duct is moving along at a high rate of speed. The detector is only capable of responding at a low speed, so we do a little sampling. Altitude, per the manufacturer's rating. There's a wonderful joke they tell about smoke detectors in airplanes and smoke detectors in Denver, which is the Mile High City. And I don't remember the joke, and I didn't really think it was that funny anyway. But they use it to start every firearm seminar from one particular vendor. Note that you cannot put smoke detectors where exposed to freezing, high temperature, high humidity, or substantial airflow. Contractors often put smoke detectors in attics because it sounds like such a good idea. But it's bad for two reasons. Dust causes false alarm, and the temperature, often 140 degrees F, exceeds the limits. Ceiling smoke detectors not within 4 inches of the wall. Wall smoke detectors not within 4 inches of the ceiling. Have we heard this before? Nice to have a consistent set of rules. Smooth ceiling, use 30-foot nominal smoke detector spacing. Joist or beams less than 10-inch spacing. Less than 10 inches in width, space the smoke detector same as a flat ceiling along the beams and 1/2 across the center lines of the beams. That's 15 feet on centers. Joist or beams over 12 inches wide, locate smoke detectors on the beams or in every pocket, maximum of 30-foot spacing. Air sampling smoke detector. This is a complicated, high-cost, high-maintenance item, but very, very appropriate for inaccessible locations if a maintenance program exists. What happens is you get a little pump, looks like something goes with a fish tank, and it's got little hoses, look like something go with a fish tank, and they suck in air from different parts of the building, and they run it through one detector. And by keeping track of which of the solenoids has been made, you know which one's an alarm, and you can communicate the information back to the fire alarm. They are very expensive because they include supervisory devices. You know if the thing's working or not working. Projected beam smoke detectors are located in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions. Very, very appropriate for large places such as warehouse, auditoriums, or non-dusty factories. Will not false trip easily. Sensitive to genuine smoke plume. Raised floors and suspended ceilings are to be treated as separate rooms. And remember, once again, if the duct detector is present for the return air, it reduces the requirements somewhat. The raised floors is a very hairy situation. There's a separate book on this, and I can't tell you the number right now, but if you're doing one of those, get a copy of that separate book. You know, it's like $10 or $20, so it's not a big deal to get it, and a lot of times people will loan it to you. Keep smoke detectors away from HVAC suppliers or grills. Why? Because you've got the high velocity there. Once again, we got to stay within the manufacturer's spec, which is 300 feet per minute. Flame detectors. These are very specialized detectors. Work reliably with one exception. When there's an electric arc welder in the field of view, because that looks like what they respond to. And you know immediately, this is not a subtle concealed defect. If it trips and trips and trips, it's picking up something that's causing it to trip. You can replace it a couple times, but the new one will keep tripping too. Sprinkler flow switches. The fire alarm designer confirms that the fire alarm will accept switch contacts, but switches themselves are purchased and installed by the piping contractor. Problems arise when the piping designer isn't familiar with the sprinkler code. The fire alarm designer must coordinate. Detection of other suppression systems. Flow or water in foam systems, pump activation, pressure, mechanical release, provided in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions. Again, this is a coordination issue with the kitchen equipment supplier or the suppression system supplier. Pull stations throughout the protected area so that they are conspicuous, unobstructed, and accessible. Many persons, including some fire alarm designers, think that pull stations are required only at exit doors. They are required in school hallways, in kitchens, and in places where there is a reasonable likelihood of fire. The handbook discussion of this section specifically authorizes the use of plastic covers and covers with sounders to reduce false alarms. Pull stations must be within 5 feet of exit doorways on each floor. Pull stations must be on both sides of doors more than 40 feet wide. Pull stations not more than 200-foot spacing on any floor. Remember, this requirement only applies to specific types of construction and use groups. Stores are usually excluded. Sprinkler valve tamper switches, a pressure switch, and off normal and return to normal signaling. Smoke detectors for smoke control. There's an effort to provide smoke control for the firefighters. The section offers optional smoke detectors to report to the control location on the effects of manually starting and stopping fans and opening and closing dampers. And we've talked about this previously, how it's been changed in the 2007 edition. And it was vague before, and it's vague now. But smoke control is more than simply shutting down the fan. There is a concept here that we're going to improve the safety for the people that are trying to evacuate the building. Duct smoke detectors. Other codes require the detectors and specify their locations. This code specifies details of construction and installation details. The HVAC designer is responsible for locating duct detectors. The fire alarm designer does this only when there's a retrofit to a fire alarm to an old building that did not have duct detectors. It's essential to work closely with an HVAC designer familiar with the HVAC codes for the community. Now, there's meaning here that may be a little bit concealed. If you're doing a fire alarm retrofit, there may not be an HVAC designer on the project because all you're doing is fire alarms. What this says, and what I mean is, go up to your friendly HVAC designer and ask him about it because he normally does it. You don't normally do it. You're not familiar with the codes that are required, and you should have an HVAC guy you can talk to without getting into trouble. Really and truly, you can talk to a vendor too. I feel guilty about this because I don't like to be beholden to vendors. I don't like them to think they've got an edge over me. I like to know my business. But for goodness sake, when you need an answer and they've got the answer, you go to them and ask. Duct detectors are very, very similar to standard smoke detectors with three exceptions. First, the duct detector uses a sampling tube to provide low velocity flow of air within the feet per minute specs of the detector. Second, an old-style duct detector has two alarm contacts, one to shut down the fan and another to alarm to the central system. Fire alarm vendors now prefer an addressable detector and a supervised relay to shut down the fan. This accommodates a more advanced smoke control system through the fire alarm panel. Third, a duct smoke detector requires a manual test reset station if the detector location is inaccessible. And over 10 feet is inaccessible. Yeah, you can see it up there. Yeah, you can get at it with a ladder, but according to the code, it's inaccessible. This is an old requirement and is new to be enforced, so it's something to be aware of. Smoke detectors indoor release service. Either area smoke detectors or dedicated door smoke detectors may be used. Area smoke detectors perform the function via programming in the fire alarm control panel. Dedicated smoke detectors on both sides of the door must have contacts rated for the voltage and current of the door hold electromagnet. Now, that again implies more than might be obvious. In the earlier discussion, we talked about 15 milliamps at 24 volts. Absolutely true, but that's not the only kind. There are also 15 milliamp at 120 volts AC. Well, you've got to have the right contacts on the dedicated smoke detectors to operate the door hold magnet. If you're doing it off the central system, chances are you're doing it off of a multiplexed relay, auxiliary relay anyway, and those typically have pretty substantial contacts. Connection dedicated detectors to the general fire alarm system is optional. The door hold has to have detectors. The detectors may or may not be hooked up to the central system. Certainly, I'd hook them up to the central system because I'd rather get a little extra safety at essentially no extra cost. Evacuation is not a required output. It's common in high-rise buildings to evacuate only the affected floor and the floors above or below. Hospitals and prisons generally do not evacuate at all. Usually they have a place of safe refuge where they can move people and keep them within the facility. Computerized fire alarms must have restricted access for changes. Four levels of passwords are shown in the example. Non-required systems must meet all requirements of this code. You can't do something on the side. If it's a fire alarm, it's an NFPA 72 fire alarm. Required features. One or more of the following define it as a fire alarm. Pull stations, automatic alarm signal initiation, trouble notification for fire suppression systems, activation of suppression systems, activation of fire safety functions such as elevator recall and fan shutdown. Activation of alarm notification appliances, emergency voice alarm communications, guards tour supervisory service, process monitoring supervision, such as refrigeration failure, activation of off-premises signals, combination systems, integrated systems. Now, why are we listing this? What does this have to do with our course? Okay. There are two questions that are answered by this list. One question is, what are you allowed to have in a fire alarm? Well, you're allowed to have guard tour supervisory service. What does that mean? An old idea, and it may be a current idea still, was that the guard goes around and turns a key in each of the rooms he visits so you know he visited the room. Sometimes they have a clock and the key is attached to the room and he just turns the thing in the clock. I've seen that many, many times. Again, in years gone by, I haven't been wandering around museums after dark much lately. But another way of doing it is to do it through the fire alarm system, and it's an acceptable activity according to the code. Now, what I was looking for in this, I was trying to get a quick list of what you had to put in this minimal fire alarm system, and I did not get that because after I carefully copied all these down, I saw it said one or more of the following. But all of them that we just listed, pull stations, alarm signal initiation, trouble notification on suppression systems, all these are fire alarm functions. Notifications shall occur within 10 seconds of activation of the initiating devices. There are very limited exceptions to this. It's a real good concept to carry with you. Sometimes they will let a guard, a live person, delay the evacuation signal, but it's not for an extended period. It's like for 60 seconds or something. And again, that's not the point here. The point is very much to know that it exists, not to know what the nuances and details are. If you're real interested in the nuances and details, you should be talking to your authority having jurisdiction, because that's where you'll get the best information. Now, I've got some more terms I'd like to discuss with you, but according to the clock, it's a good time to take a break. And I would enjoy taking a break. I hope you have a good break also, and we will rejoin in a few minutes.